When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 281, Great Debates in Fitness and in Health. This is our fourth iteration of that, but it's part two. It ran a little long the last time we were recording. We're up to an hour and 45 minutes of audio, and honestly, no one's going to sit through that. At least I don't think so. So we split it up. On this particular episode, we're arguing over whether or not GLP-1 receptor agonists like Wegovy, Ozempic, and so on cause additional muscle loss compared to other methods of weight management. What's up with BMI? Why do people keep talking about it if it's so terrible? CrossFit, is CrossFit good or bad for health and performance? Exercise and pregnancy, specifically, are the current recommendations good enough to promote health in pregnant women? And finally, overtraining. Does overtraining exist in resistance training? Again, this is episode 281, Great Debates in Fitness and in Health with myself, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and Dr. Austin Baraki. Let's get right into it. Next question. This is on GLP-1 receptor agonists, so things like semaglutide, Ozempic, Wegovy, etc., and muscle loss. When there is an overall energy deficit, that is, there less calories have been consumed than are being used over a sustained period of time, people lose weight. Stored fat is liberated from body fat and used as energy, as well as other energy stores in the body, namely glycogen in the liver and, to a lesser extent, protein in the muscle. Well, those are all released in circulation and they're used for energy. Fat mass decreases during this period because body fat stores are being used as energy, but also because stored fat and glycogen contain water. And because of that fact, fat-free mass, also known as lean body mass, is reduced too. The average amount of actual muscle loss after decreases in body weight are less clear. At present, there's this 1/4 fat-free mass rule where a quarter of all weight loss is probably muscle. That's commonly cited, though this is only an approximation that likely best applies to people who aren't exercising during periods of weight loss. In bariatric surgery, for example, the average proportion of lean mass loss is about 20 to 30% of all weight loss. In studies on anti-obesity medications like semaglutide, one study found that after 68 weeks, about 40% of the weight loss was fat-free mass. In another study, fat-free mass loss was 30% after 72 weeks. The debate proposition is as follows. Do GLP-1 receptor agonists and other anti-obesity medications cause more muscle loss than other weight loss interventions? I guess I get to start this one off. And I will take the position that yes, GLP-1 receptor agonists do cause more muscle loss than other weight loss interventions. And I will take this similar to some of our other things to allow you to share some high quality information here. So I will respond in the affirmative because these anti-obesity medications in general cause a large amount of weight loss compared to most other weight loss interventions, especially lifestyle interventions. So like diet, exercise, sleep modification, other behavioral change, etc. While those interventions can cause dramatic weight loss in a select few, on average, the amount of weight loss is relatively small. The best you can really hope for on average is somewhere between 5 to 10% of total body weight, initial body weight loss at about a year. And at 3 years, that goes down to a little bit less. And at 5 years, that in most folks, it will not have produced a clinically significant weight loss of at least 5% of starting body weight. This means that the average amount of actual lean body mass loss is quite low. And folks who are undertaking these drastic lifestyle interventions and who are actually adherent to those lifestyle interventions are also likely exercising, thus further preserving some of this lean body mass being lost. Compare that to anti-obesity medications that produce a far greater amount of weight loss. And well, you're just going to see a significant amount of muscle mass and lean body mass loss as well. Lean body mass in general from the water, the glycogen stored in the liver, water stored in the fat mass itself, and other non-fat mass that's been lost. But I think if, you know, what I expect my colleague to argue back against is that the relative proportion of lean body mass loss is about the same compared to other weight loss interventions that where people actually do lose weight. And I think that based on present evidence, you would be tough to support that with reams of data because there's just not a lot of evidence on people taking these anti-obesity medications and simultaneously exercising and simultaneously eating a sufficient amount of protein to prevent excessive amounts of lean body mass loss. How I will caveat my answer further is that even if this was the case, where there is a greater proportion of lean body mass loss using anti-obesity medications compared to lifestyle only, I think it's worth it because the individuals who these medications are well suited for are already carrying a lot of lean body mass. And so if they happen to lose a little bit more than they would otherwise lose from lifestyle modification alone, I'm okay with that because they still have more than enough to live a full and complete life. Now they're less likely to suffer from obesity-related complications because they have lost that excess fat mass. So that is my take. I do think that it is possible, perhaps even likely, that the lean body mass loss overall is greater with GLP-1 like a GLP-1 receptor agonist and other anti-obesity medications compared to lifestyle only. But I also don't know that it matters if true.
Yeah. This is an interesting topic. And there's, I think, a lot of threads to pull on here. The first is that it is the evidence that was cited. I'm aware of that study where the one study with semaglutide where about 40% was fat-free mass. As you mentioned, we don't have a ton of data looking at this specific question just yet. And so I think that in general, we try to base our confidence in our positions based on an overall body of evidence. And I think that that overall body of evidence is not so substantial yet for us to have very, very confident positions on this. I think it is a hypothesis with some support that these medicines may induce a bit more lean body mass loss, but I would definitely want to see more more evidence looking at this specific question before I felt more confident on that. The next aspect is just that we've been referring to fat-free mass or lean body mass, which, as you mentioned, is a combination of different things. It's not the same thing as muscle mass. It's muscle mass, it's water weight, which I don't particularly care if that decreases, and it's bone mass. So there are other variables at play besides just muscle loss. When we think about those things, you know, is it preferable? Is it ideal for somebody to have loss of muscle mass? Not preferable, not ideal in general. Is it preferable for them to have bone mass loss? Also not preferable, not ideal. However, if somebody is starting out with a reasonable amount of muscle mass and bone mass, and through the process of losing weight, they do have a decrease in muscle loss and bone mass. However, for example, through the lens of bone loss, if they experience that, yet for the rest of their life, they never experience any kind of negative consequence of that. They never have an osteoporotic fracture, then it did not matter that their bone mass decreased a bit because they never experienced any actual real harm from it. It was just a number. And again, I recognize people get DEXA scans, and if the number goes down, they panic. I do these consults all the time when really I have to try to explain to people that, hey, why do we care about this? We care about this insofar as it relates to your risk of having a fracture that significantly leads to disability, complications, or death. If you never experience any of those things, then this number changing did not really matter for you in your life. The same thing applies to the muscle mass. If somebody has a modest decrement in the amount of muscle mass they have, yet they never experience a negative consequence of that, i.e. sarcopenia. And I will say that the vast majority of patients on these medicines are not developing clinical sarcopenia. If they are, then I'm discontinuing those medicines. If I see such a patient who is cachectic on a GLP-1 agonist, that's actually happened twice in the past year where I've seen somebody who's very thin, usually they have like advanced cancer and nobody stopped their diabetes medicine. I just stop it. You know, that's fine. So the aspect of the lean body mass is recognizing that lean body mass is not the same as muscle mass. And even if somebody loses muscle mass and bone mass, why do we care about that? It's insofar as it impacts their life, their function, and their health outcomes. If those decrease a bit, yet they never experience a fracture or clinical sarcopenia or something like that, then I can't make a strong case that that really mattered. Whereas to the extent that at the same time, the concomitant loss of a significant amount of body fat resolved their metabolic syndrome, or recent data on tirzepatide having dramatic improvements in fatty liver disease, steatohepatitis, things like that, which is a major risk factor for premature heart disease, which is, again, the leading cause of death worldwide, I would take a decrease in my risk of dying from the leading cause of death worldwide versus a modest or even moderate decrease in fat in bone or muscle mass that never actually has a negative consequence on my life or physical function. And then the last comment that I'll make here is that, you know, when we think about what are the variables that impact the amount of lean body mass, bone, muscle that somebody has, there's going to be some genetic predisposition. There's going to be some nutritional component. Oversimplifying it, we can call it dietary protein. There's more to it than that, but we'll reduce it down to that for now. And then physical activity. Looking at, you know, weight loss through quote unquote lifestyle interventions of diet plus exercise and comparing that to medication alone fails to control for a rather substantial variable that drives, you know, the trajectory of lean body mass. And so what you would really want to see is this medical or surgical intervention, the GLP-1 medicine or metabolic surgery plus exercise and nutrition versus the lifestyle intervention, the diet and exercise alone, because you then would effectively control for the impact of exercise on lean body mass itself. And when my hypothesis, if we were to do something like that, have people on these GLP-1 meds with guideline, you know, meeting physical activity guidelines, consuming sufficient dietary protein, I think that if we drew a bell curve of the amount of lean body mass that people lost on these medicines, it would be drastically shifted in a favorable direction, meaning far, far, far fewer people would experience any significant amount of lean body mass loss. And it would be even better if we could quantify that in terms of bone and muscle rather than just lean body mass in general, because again, water loss is irrelevant to me as an outcome.
Yeah. Interesting that you say that. There was a study in 2023. This was done in Denmark. It's a double-blind randomized controlled trial where they actually compared people doing exercise alone, taking placebo alone, taking liraglutide, which is the oldest anti-obesity yep. medication we have, maybe the worst working one, but like they use that anyway, or doing exercise with liraglutide. And this yep. is 1 year, all right, 166 individuals in this, 85% completed the study. So body weight wise, there was the placebo group after the year increased their body weight on average by 6 kilos. The exercise only group, so not getting the medication, increased their body weight by an additional 7.7 kilos on top of that. So they did not lose weight in the year. The placebo alone or the exercise group alone did not decrease body weight. Liraglutide lost an additional 2 kilos. They had all lost 13 kilos before the study actually started. So they lost even more weight with the liraglutide, and the combination of exercise and liraglutide had an additional on top of that 6 kilos. So they lost 8 kilos total after the 13 kilo weight loss kind of run in. Body fat went down in the exercise group by about 2%. Liraglutide on its own decreased body fat by 2%. And the combination of liraglutide and exercise decreased body fat by about 4%. And so it's like, okay, more favorable body composition, greater weight loss. Like these are all the things that you would expect with the anti-obesity medication. In this case, the worst working one that we have. And you add exercise, you get a sort of a beneficial effect. I just think that if you compare it to lifestyle only, so diet and exercise only, the amount of weight loss that you're going to get from an anti-obesity medication is going to be far superior to that. And so the likelihood that you're going to see a decrease in fat-free mass in lean body mass as a whole, it seems more probable. Whether that's actual muscle tissue, don't know, because to your point, water, I don't think I care about. And further, it's not outside the realm of possibility to lose a significant amount of lean body mass through diet alone if you're not exercising, especially if you happen to lose a lot of weight. That study, the case report rather, on the guy who fasted for like 382 days or whatever, his lean body mass went down by a lot. Like close, close to, it was over 40%, as I recall. And it's like, and you know, nobody's like, oh, the lifestyle alone is going to cause a huge drop in fat-free mass. And it's like, well, you know, if you're not exercising, yeah, that's kind of what we predict. And if you lose a lot of weight, we expect some loss as well. So yeah, ultimately I think this is a nothing sandwich, but you know, people be saying.
It makes sense though, when you think about like the people who worry about this the most are people who are like into health and fitness and things like that, people for whom, you know, their prioritization on, you know, strength and muscle mass and stuff like that is so high that almost any decrease is like intolerable to them. But that just fails to accurately, you know, weigh the two different issues at play. Any amount of lean body mass loss to them is intolerable without really noticing that the risk of carrying the excess body fat for a long duration of time, the risk of that far exceeds any risk of a even modest decrease or even moderate decrease in lean body mass.
Yeah, there was a study also at bariatric surgery where they had people exercise after the bariatric procedure. And yeah, the exercise, they actually lost obviously more fat mass, but their strength increased by up to 36% in the interim. So it's like, even despite maybe
training works. Yeah.
Yeah, training works. Yeah. We'll wrap it up as training works. All right, next question, getting closer to the end here. This is on body mass index, BMI. So body mass index, or BMI, compares an individual's weight to their height squared. It came into use in the 1980s, and current recommendations and guidelines developed by a number of national and international organizations, such as the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology, and the Obesity Society, all recommend an annual BMI measurement for adults. In most populations, a cutoff of greater than 25 should be used to prompt further evaluation for risk of obesity and obesity-related diseases, whereas a BMI cutoff of greater than 23 should be used for adults of South Asian, Southeast Asian, and East Asian descent. Now, BMI has been widely criticized, with a recent American Medical Association report suggesting that BMI has caused harm and may not be accurate anyway. The debate proposition is as follows. Dr. Baraki, is BMI a useful screening tool for health?
I feel like we've developed a new strategy in these debates to just force the other person into a particular position that they are well-versed in. So there. I'll say no here, that BMI is not a useful screening tool for health. I think that, you know, broadly speaking, it is a very crude metric, just measuring somebody's weight and their height and comparing the two. And using that to extrapolate, you know, predictions about people's health trajectory and health risks across the entire global population. Now, admittedly, there have been in more recent years kind of more ethnic specific kind of cutoffs. And this is due to recognition that different people may manifest cardiometabolic and other obesity related complications at different levels of BMI cutoffs. And so, you know, for example, I recently shared with you this paper that found that among South Asian populations, a BMI of 21, which would otherwise be fit in squarely into a healthy, quote unquote, normal BMI, carries the same risk for these complications as a BMI of 30 among European populations. And so if we just look, crudely speaking, at just this BMI number, let's say for the sake of argument right now, without this kind of like subpopulation ethnic specific cutoffs, it's a very crude metric on that. So it clearly needs more refinement than just measure the height and weight and you can get, you know, a useful screening tool for like yes at risk, no not at risk. The other considerations, and this is stuff that we've cited before, is that BMI, you know, when we talk about what makes a useful screening tool, we would want a good screening tool. For those who want more detail on that, we've talked about screening a bunch, including a dedicated podcast episode. We want it to be very, very sensitive to rule out people who are not at elevated risk. And so, unfortunately, when we look at BMI's performance on the sensitivity side of things, meaning that if you have a normal BMI that we can very, very confidently say that you are not at elevated risk, it performs exceptionally poorly at that. And so for that reason, there have been arguments, which I'm sure you'll also discuss, that to add an additional metric to it, being the waist measurement, to further refine risk kind of estimation and prognostication. So I think that for at least those two basic reasons, certainly more that I could get into, but the crudeness of it without further ethnic, specific refinement, in other words, not BMI alone, but accounting for BMI and adding additional variables to your equation to include ethnicity, waist circumference, things like that. It performs poorly as a screening tool in multiple ways and most clearly not having enough sensitivity to be a good screening tool. If I want to have a good screening test, it should have, you know, well over 90% sensitivity, 95, you know, really, really high sensitivity to say if it's negative, I'm done. I don't need to do any further testing. That's the best kind of screening tool. Tests where I do it and I'm like, I'm still not sure I need to do more, it's really not a great screening tool. In my mind, I've actually wondered this before, you know, and part of this is just due to convenience of measuring BMI, but what would be the downsides, aside from just potential inconvenience, of just replacing BMI with waist measurement altogether? Mm-hmm. You may still, of course, need to have some ethnic-specific cutoffs there, because even there we'll likely have some imperfections. But I do think that waist measurement is more likely to better account for the negative effects of fat distribution, whereas BMI does not really account for fat distribution, as well as, you know, of course, muscularity and things like that. But that's a tiny fraction of the population. So you're up.
Yeah, no, that's a reasonable take. And I think, you know, having to take the affirmative here that BMI is a useful screening tool, the problem with the way the proposition is phrased is by using the term screening. Because you're exactly right that BMI has issues with being a useful screening tool, in addition to wanting ethnic and maybe perhaps geographical and also maybe age-specific sort of cutoffs. Like, we don't really have that yet, at least the way and how BMI is used currently. And further, yes, you're missing about half of people who are, in fact, at risk of obesity-related complications and obesity-related symptoms using a BMI cutoff of 30. Now, if you have a BMI of 30 or higher, it is very specific in that, wow, with almost 95 to 99% certainty, I can say, well, you're probably carrying too much body fat and you are at risk of obesity-related disease. So, but that's not very useful for a screening tool. You would want something else that captures everybody and then use a confirmatory test or series of tests that, again, rules out all the people who are actually don't have the disease. So, yeah, it's difficult to argue that BMI is the best screening tool outside of taking it down a path of the existing data that we have, which is overwhelmingly, BMI centric. So we just have all of this existing data on BMI and how it correlates to risk of various obesity related complications and symptoms. And so because of that existing data, you can't really replace it with something else like a waist to hip ratio, like a waist circumference, like even a body fat test. Like, all of these things could have been used, decades ago, and then we'd have those mountains of data to use instead. And I'm with you. I think a waist circumference maybe be a better sort of screening tool, except for the fact we don't have as much data on that to actually establish cutoffs and norms in a way that would make it a more effective screening tool. So while BMI isn't perfect, it's what we have and what we have a ton of data on. And to be used in practice, it should be combined with another metric to your point, account for body fat distribution and also further sort of refine the screening tool, which in most cases is just a waist circumference. So due to the existing amount of data being BMI centric, it is a useful screening tool, although it is improved with adding additional tests. The racism claim, the harm claim about, denying patients various procedures or interventions based on BMI, and there being some squish with various ethnicities, I find all of that to be interesting, but not compelling for completely throwing away, throwing the baby out with the bathwater and saying that BMI is not useful. It's like, well, yeah, we acknowledge those limitations, but we still have this data and it can still be useful. It's made better if you combine it with something like a waist circumference. And I think that's also fine because it's quick, easy, cheap to obtain.
Yeah. And an example of how decision-making has been impacted by that is, as we cited in the Metabolic Bariatric Surgery podcast, how kind of eligibility criteria have shifted a little bit in terms of what are the BMI cutoffs for consideration of metabolic bariatric surgery, whether 35 kilograms per meter squared or greater, or 40, now down to 30 and 35. As it compared with what it's been in the past. My only, theoretical rebuttal here is just kind of like imagining a world in which we had very confident, say, geographic or ethnic specific waist measurement cutoffs. And if we relied exclusively on that and threw away BMI, I don't know that much would be lost, honestly, mm-hmm. if we just went purely based off of ethnic specific waist measurement cutoffs. I don't think we'd be missing out on very much by not using BMI in that context. And so that's, I think that there are still, again, time, convenience. A lot of patients with obesity would probably prefer to not have their waist measurement measured every time they went to a doctor's visit. Some issues with, the psychological stress and stigma around that as well. But I think purely from like a risk prediction screening kind of a standpoint, my gut kind of tells me that would probably be better, or at least that we wouldn't lose much by jettisoning BMI in that kind of a situation.
Yeah, because the only thing is, like, people can self-report their weight and height with like an acceptable degree of error, right? Whereas waist circumference, they can't.
They just give you their pant size and it's wrong. Yeah.
And then the measurement error in waist circumference by people doing it, you introduce a whole slew of problems there. And so, yeah, like, I acknowledge that there are limitations to the BMI. It's not perfect, but it's useful and can be made more useful with some additional testing. So,
yeah. Yeah.
For all the golfers in the audience, you've probably heard of PXG by seeing them on the PGA Tour in the hands of guys like Joel Damon, Zach Johnson, and Luke List. Well, they're bringing that same passion for excellence to their new line of apparel, and I gotta say, they nailed it. I just got another polo from them, and both the fit and performance are excellent. They're really versatile as well, meaning I can wear them out to eat or take a meeting without signaling to everyone that I'm about to play golf. PXG apparel has something for everyone. They got pants, polos, sweaters, hats, quarter zips, joggers, jackets, skirts, everything you could want. I've got a few of their hats and a few of their polos, but some of their mid-layers look great too. We've got a special offer for our audience. If you're looking to elevate your style game on and off the course, check out the PXG Spring and Summer 2024 collections. Head over to pxg.com/barbell and use the code barbell at checkout to save 10% on all apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. That's code B-A-R-B-E-L-L to save 10% on apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of my questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys. All right, next question here on Great Debates in Fitness and Health, episode number 4 with Dr. Austin Baraki. This is on CrossFit. The people really went in on these propositions here. So CrossFit is a brand, but the training most commonly associated with it revolves around a workout of the day, also known as a WOD, that combines elements of gymnastics, Olympic weightlifting, traditional resistance training, and endurance exercise. While there's no consensus definition of what is and what isn't a CrossFit workout, I think most would agree that the combination of these different training styles into a single workout done in a somewhat competitive setting, so either for time or total reps, is uniquely CrossFit. Similar to BMI, CrossFit has been widely criticized by many for being dangerous, silly, and more. Despite these criticisms, CrossFit is huge, with over 300,000 people participating in their yearly test of fitness, the CrossFit Open, in 2023. The debate proposition is as follows. Is CrossFit a good form of exercise for health and performance? I guess I'll just take the affirmative and I'll make you contrive a position against me. So I think CrossFit is a perfectly fine way to meet and likely exceed the current physical activity guidelines. So the twice weekly resistance training and achieving 500 to 1,000 met minutes of conditioning per week, that would be about 150 minutes of, you know, moderate to vigorous intensity aerobic activity. I think, you know, if someone prefers CrossFit, gets hooked by that community setting, has the means to, you know, participate in CrossFit, it's all fine. I can't find a way to argue against it from a health perspective, meaning that if somebody did just, you know, the most optimal program, they had both of us for whatever collaborating on their programming and whatever, like, I don't know that their health would be further improved by doing that compared to CrossFit. So from that, I feel relatively confident in my position. From a performance standpoint, this would just depend on how you're measuring performance. If performance is measured in a CrossFit type setting or something that is, you know, uniquely found in CrossFit, so one of these mixed modal, you know, conditioning or Metcon sessions, or something heavily trained in CrossFit, like a gymnastics focused type test that you otherwise probably wouldn't put in somebody's programming, then I think CrossFit's, yeah, probably the best for performance for those things. If you knew the test ahead of time and it looked a lot like CrossFit, well, guess what you would do? You would do a lot of stuff that looked like CrossFit. If you're testing performance by more, we'll call them traditional measures, so like a 1RM squat, bench, deadlift, you know, power clean, snatch, max pull-ups, I mean, whatever. the more removed you get from the test being CrossFit, well, then you make the argument that the training of CrossFit is not the best way to prepare for that test. And I don't know that that's unique to CrossFit, though, meaning that you wouldn't do powerlifting, you know, as the training program for somebody who wasn't going to, you know, test their performance or evaluate their performance via some sort of powerlifting related or powerlifting specific sort of test. Like, you wouldn't do powerlifting to get ready for a bodybuilding show or for a 5K. If that's the type of resistance training you enjoy, that's great, but that would be adjunctive, you know, an adjunct sort of training style to the 5K training, to the bodybuilding training, whatever. So yeah, I think I feel relatively confident that another training method would not improve health more. And then for performance, as long as we're making the caveat that performance is being tested in something that is heavily trained within CrossFit, I think that it's fine. I suspect that my colleague, Dr. Baraki, will argue that it's likely not going to be best for performance due to the inherent, we'll call it, randomness within CrossFit. And so if you knew the test, and even if it looked a lot like CrossFit, actual CrossFit training would not be the best way to prepare for it. You would just want to do elements of that test more frequently than you would otherwise see in traditional CrossFit programming, which I can think is a very contrived position, but I'll allow you to take that stance in your rebuttal.
Yeah, this one's an exceptionally difficult one to argue against. As you said, you couldn't even really think of a way to do it. So insofar as it gets you to anything that could resemble meeting or exceeding the physical activity guidelines, then we're already good on the health front. How could it negatively or not be a good form of exercise for the health front? I'd have to make up a few different semi-ridiculous, you know, counter arguments here. I suppose one is that in the way the question was framed, it did kind of describe it as being, you know, the style of training done in a competitive environment, you know, for total time, total reps, et cetera, that being more uniquely CrossFit. Insofar as that represents being done in a CrossFit gym, I think that there's a valid argument about the accessibility of that. Most CrossFit gyms in general are relatively expensive compared with a lot of other, you know, forms or methods or modes of exercise. And broadly speaking, much of the population, both in the US and worldwide, it's not going to be accessible to them at those prices of, you know, somewhere sometimes ranging between $100 a month to, I don't know, $300+ a month for some of these gyms is not realistic for a lot of people. So accessibility is kind of a knock there. The aspect of it being done in like a competitive environment for time, for total reps, with Skrillex blasting overhead, for a lot of people who are just getting into it for the first time, the environment can be conducive to people doing too much too soon. I don't think that that is necessarily a uniquely CrossFit thing of people, you know, doing too much too soon. You see this in the, you know, the trope about weekend warriors and things like that. Although some interesting caveats of, if I wanted to argue against myself, papers within the past year, I think it might have been in JAMA, immediately coming to me, looking at health outcomes among people who are stereotypical quote-unquote weekend warriors compared to those who distribute their exercise more evenly throughout the week, and the health outcomes were the same. Mm-hmm. And so not a, you know, if they didn't do anything for many days of the week and then like went hard on the weekend, they seemed to do all right from a health outcome standpoint. Not to say that's how we would do it, but just that's some of the evidence that we have. But doing too much too soon is a very common way for people to develop, you know, DOMS to severe DOMS to rhabdo to acute injuries. And certainly I've seen many cases of rhabdo from CrossFit, but I've also seen many cases of rhabdo from various other forms of exercise, both conditioning related, resistance related, military training related, even non-exercise related rhabdo. So it's a prevalent problem nonetheless. And then as it relates to performance, I mean, yeah, the only lens to look at this through is performance in what outcome? And honestly, you know, this I feel like has been discussed a fair amount over the years, and you've talked about it quite a bit as far as if you wanted to train for competitive CrossFit, what would your training look like? And I don't think I would agree if the claim is that your training wouldn't look like CrossFit. I think that for sure you would need to do training sessions that involved mixed modality type things for time, for, you know, for effort, whatever the case is. I do think that you would need to do a fair amount of stereotypical CrossFit workouts. Of course, you may need to develop certain other physical abilities, depending on your strengths and weaknesses, outside of the context of a dedicated quote unquote WOD. So if you have no idea how to do a handstand walk or something, it's unlikely that you're going to get really good at it only ever trying to do that in the context of a for time effort or something like that. So that's just like reasonably intelligent programming to strengthen weaknesses specific to a particular task. So I do think that, you know, it is a fine way to train for CrossFit, but it probably needs to be augmented depending on the individual. So I don't think that I've come down on a firm position here, aside from just making up caveats like it has to be done in a competitive CrossFit gym environment that you're paying for, and you're like relatively new, and you're susceptible to the environmental effects that lead you to go too hard too soon, and you're, you know, so that's the probably the best I can do here.
Yeah. I mean, I think people, listeners will notice the, you know, neither of us really cited an increased risk of injury, because that doesn't seem to be borne out by actual evidence, outside of maybe the caveat people starting exercise like very new and maybe doing too much too soon. That seems to be a risk, but I don't know that that's unique to CrossFit. A susceptible individual, whether it's a psychological and or environmental thing or those things coming together. Well, yeah, I suspect that would happen in multiple different situations. And further, you know, I think this all goes back to the point, like with the performance thing. It's like, if you were trying to get better at CrossFit, right, would your training look a lot like CrossFit? And to your point, yes, you would include a lot of CrossFit specific elements. However, it would be tailored to your strengths and weaknesses. When I did my little CrossFit experiment, you know how many times I bench pressed during that?
Yeah, zero.
None. I don't have to. I'm too strong. I'm too strong on a bench. I didn't have to deadlift either or squat either, but back squat. I just needed a front squat, do Olympic weightlifting, do gymnastics, and then get my lungs up and then figure out how to pace a workout. Now, that didn't really work out for me. But
yeah,
in contrast, if you were trying to get somebody's performance in CrossFit to be the best, you wouldn't stop doing CrossFit to just do a strength block without doing any of the metabolic conditioning or other conditioning. You might program those strength elements a little bit more intelligently, and not just have like, okay, on Monday, we're going to do 5 heavy singles at your max jerk, you know, and then, you know, 2 days later, you're going to do EMOM of power snatch, you know, or whatever. It's like, yeah, we could probably program that a little bit more specifically, but I think now you're just really getting into the weeds on like how certain types of CrossFit is programmed, and that's not really representative of CrossFit at large. So look, we're not getting paid by CrossFit. Neither of us prefer CrossFit as our particular fitness kink, preferred fitness kink, but like, it's fine. Like, it's just fine.
Agree.
Okay. Second to last question here. This is on exercise in pregnancy. With over 3.7 million live births in the United States yearly, exercise guidance for women before, during, and after pregnancy is obviously super important. Now, the first exercise guidelines during pregnancy from the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, also known as ACOG, well, those were introduced in 1985, which recommended limiting heart rate in mom to 140 beats per minute or less, and this was only for women who exercised prior to becoming pregnant. The latest recommendations are reflected in the 2019 Canadian Guidelines for Exercise During Pregnancy. Those are effectively the same as the current physical activity guidelines, twice weekly resistance training, plus, you know, 150 minutes at least of moderate to vigorous physical activity conditioning. And they're also reflected in the ACOG's committee opinion number 804. To summarize those, physical activity and exercise in pregnancy are associated with minimal risks and have been shown to benefit most women, although some modification to exercise routines may be necessary because of normal anatomic and physiologic changes and fetal requirements. The recommendations go on to say that resistance training has been, and I quote, extensively studied in pregnancy and found to be safe and beneficial. Interestingly, ACOG goes on to say that resistance training, and I quote again, was not considered a safe activity in early guidelines for exercise during pregnancy because of potential injury and possible fetal heart decelerations resulting from Valsalva maneuvers. Consequently, there is sparse literature on this topic. Like, why did they say just two opposing things in the same? Okay. They go on to say that it is prudent for elite athletes who wish to continue strenuous activity during pregnancy to have a clear understanding of the risks, to obtain approval from their healthcare providers, and to consider decreasing resistance load compared with pre-pregnant conditions. The debate proposition is as follows. Are the current exercise recommendations during pregnancy adequate for health promotion for mom and baby? Austin, how do you respond?
I'm going to take the affirmative yes position. They are adequate for health promotion. If the counter to this is that they're not adequate and we should be recommending even more activity, I think you're going to have a hard time making that that argument based on literally no evidence, and recognizing that of all, you know, pregnant individuals, very few of them are meeting these guideline recommended amounts of each of these things. It's very, very uncommon for a woman who's pregnant to meet both the strength and conditioning aspects of these guidelines. And so I would not argue that they need to be more. The other potential counter would be they're not adequate. In fact, they need to be more conservative, in which case, similarly, you'd need some good evidence on which to base that argument. And it sounds like even from these committee guidelines from the American and Canadian organizations, they're saying, well, these guidelines have progressively liberalized over the years. not necessarily exclusively due to direct evidence, but also just lack of accumulating evidence of harm and a lot of experiential sort of guidance and things like that. It's interesting that they say, you quoted, you know, it's prudent for elite athletes who want to continue strenuous activity during pregnancy to have a clear understanding of the risks, when literally nobody has a clear understanding of the risks. Right. Like, if you say that, it's like, then the obstetrician who's sitting in clinic is like, hold up, I'm supposed to give them a clear understanding of the risk? Like, on what basis do I have, not only in general, but for the specific person in front of me? What if they're like an elite bobsledder or something? Like, do I have data from elite pregnant bobsledders on what the risk is of continuing their strenuous training? And so I think these are just phrases that are nice to say for, like, you know, to sound professional and for I don't know, legal coverage and things like that in the guidelines, but it's just unrealistic to do these things. However, if we look at what are the known risks of insufficient physical activity, of sedentary behavior, you know, increased risks of various sorts of pregnancy-related complications related to obesity development, related to metabolic complications, blood pressure-related complications, et cetera, especially if somebody comes into the pregnancy with existing medical conditions that could stand to be improved by physical activity, then the potential risks of being very, very conservative, such as those original guidelines where they said, like, don't get your heart rate to over 140, which is remarkable that was ever advice. Wonder if, you know, obviously we weren't like beta blocking people to keep them below that, but it's even like, you know, don't get anxious or something like that. Otherwise there might be some untoward outcomes. So, you know, to this proposition, are they adequate? I feel like based on the available evidence that we have, based on a lack of just, you know, accumulation of piles of bodies of people who are, you know, dying as a result of participating in vigorous physical activity, and the potential benefits on existing conditions and reducing the risk of complications during pregnancy, I think that I would say they are adequate. And I would struggle to make an argument that they are inadequate in the direction that we need to crank up the guidance even more. If somebody wants to do more, great. They're likely to enjoy even further health benefits from it overall, but I don't have great evidence to say that they should be doing more, especially when very few people are doing much of any at all. And then I also don't have a great position to take that they should be more conservative or less, just because as they have progressively liberalized from these guideline organizations, which are going to be very conservative, and even they have liberalized these things, I have a hard time saying that we should be going back in time and restricting things even harder for general average risk uncomplicated pregnancies.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with anything that you said. And so instead, I will debate a premise that you didn't interact with at all. Yeah. I have no issues with the current recommendations besides the double speak, which I'm like, okay, this seems like a copy, an editor would have like picked up on this, but okay, they didn't. My issue is that it has not been operationalized enough to increase the uptake. The best mm-hmm. data I can find on this is that, you know, less than a quarter of all women in the peripartum, you know, sort of situation, so directly before, during, and after pregnancy, less than 25% are actually meeting these, you know, physical activity guidelines. And that's just from the aerobic standpoint, not the muscle strengthening ones. And so I just think that there's not enough information on there about how to get the patient to start exercising. And this is a very unique period in a woman's lifetime where they're interfacing with medical professionals more than they ever will. They're getting the most healthcare they'll ever get. So you have opportunity for follow-up, for like a lot of motivational interviewing, behavior change counseling, et cetera, and, you know, use of resources. This is the time. If there ever was a time outside of, you know, general physical activity promotion, this is the time where you'd actually do the damn thing. But it's just not really making a difference. And because insufficient physical activity is such a risk factor for both mom and baby, I feel strongly that these guidelines are not enough. You need behavior change, sort of counseling, tips and tricks for physicians. You need motivational interviewing sort of guide, you know, like how to do all that. And you need resources. I don't know. Have you ever checked out the Qatar physical activity guidelines?
Can't say that I have.
Okay. Well, look, they came out in 2022. There's some stuff in there that I don't really like, but on the whole, like, excellent. So not only do they list geographically, like, here are places where you can exercise outside, right? Like, you can, like, you're at parks, they've got like setups and you're like walking paths and other things like that. They also include like very specific recommendations on, yeah, reps, sets, types of exercises to train the whole body from a
sample
muscle strengthening
programming,
perspective,
basically.
And then pictures of how to do the things and like pro tips and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
Like let's have, I don't know. Now, this is all on the expectation that having more information would actually increase uptake and increase participation. I don't know that to be the case, but that is my hypothetical, that one idea of a quality improvement project in increasing uptake and exercise for people in the peripartum period for pregnant women. I don't know that that will work, but I suspect it wouldn't hurt. Outside of maybe resource, allocation. So my argument is not against that things need to be more liberalized or like restricted further, but rather there needs to be some sort of eye towards improvement in uptake. And because despite all this liberalization, I don't see a big like upward trend of pregnant individuals exercising. I think we need to get better on like, how do we get more folks to exercise? And I think increasing resources and skills related to physical activity uptake is would likely be beneficial, but I don't know that. So your rebuttal could be like, yeah, great idea, but we don't know that that works. So I see the rest of my time.
Yeah. While true, I tend to agree with you. And I don't think it's just, resources to increase uptake, but also, even more broadly speaking, like policy level stuff in terms of accessibility of physical activity type stuff. I mean, if you think about, I obviously live in a area in West Texas where I think about the amount of just like easily accessible outdoor public walkable, enjoyable spaces for such things where I live. There are some, but they're relatively limited compared with other places that I've been in the country, and certainly compared with other places that we've been in the world where, people might go most of their adult life like never needing a car because they can just like have everything they need and spend their life and work and operate within a given region really easily with a much higher amount of average day-to-day physical activity, just because of the way the city and the life and everything is set up. That's obviously a much more broad kind of level of intervention that we are certainly not experts in, but it would intuit well that all of these things would be potentially beneficial.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, last question here. And this is going to be a good one. This is on overtraining. Functional overreaching occurs when athletes experience improved performance in the days and weeks following short-term periods of increased training load. However, prolonged high training demand with inappropriate training and/or insufficient recovery may also lead to what's called non-functional overreaching, where performance does not increase. If high training loads lead to a long-term reduction in performance, this is characterized by fatigue, mood disturbances, and similar, lasting months to even years, well, that's often called overtraining syndrome. It's mostly been described in endurance sports, and relatively little data is available for lifting weights. The debate proposition is as follows. Acknowledging there is no single test or accepted criteria for overtraining syndrome, does it exist in resistance training? So I will start off here, and I will reply in the affirmative that yes, it exists. Overtraining exists in resistance training. And I think I have to go back to this sort of like semantic argument, okay, we just made up all these terms, functional overreaching, non-functional overreaching, overtraining syndrome, to characterize some generalized findings that we can't really drill down on like specific criteria. And sure, then if you're describing overtraining as like high training loads characterized by like decreased performance that lasts for months to years, okay. That probably exists. Now, I predict that my colleague here, Dr. Baraki, would argue again. It's like, well, great. Where's the evidence showing that this routinely happens and it's even a thing that we should talk about? I submit to you, I cannot provide that evidence. In fact, knowing the evidence relatively well on this, the way that they try to induce overtraining in the resistance training setting is by having people max out on squats every single day for a period of time and hoping that something happens. The problem is on a number of occasions when they do this, the people just keep getting stronger. And so in that case, you're like, well, overtraining doesn't necessarily exist in some folks, but in other folks, it may just outstrip their recovery. And then the second part of this is they're not following these folks for years afterwards to say, yeah, and performance is still down 12 months from now, even 6 months from now. It's more in the short term. And so while I think that it is possible that overtraining is a thing, I think the most confident take I could have on this is that we haven't really seen it in either the available literature or even in experience. Like, I don't know that people are training so much for a long period of time. They've outkicked their coverage for so long that nothing else bad has happened. They haven't gotten injured. They haven't gotten, you know, burnout or whatever, that they just keep doing this thing and their performance is down, down, down. And they persist in doing that for long periods of time. I haven't seen it. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist though, just because I haven't personally seen it. So that's where I'm at on this.
Yeah. I think the only counter that you alluded to is just a lack of direct evidence showing it. And I really don't have a ton more to counter with than that, honestly, because I also think that it is very plausible that such a thing could exist. And, you know, to your point, you know, in our experience, I would certainly say that I've seen plenty of people who I, you know, wanted to get coaching and we started working with them. And, you know, I'm taking their history as far as like what their previous training looked like and what's leading them to seek out additional help now. And they're like, I've been struggling or stalled or not making progress. And then I look back at what they've been doing. And a lot of times it's just, you know, programming that I would have to significantly ratchet down, most often the intensity of, less often the volume of, as in the resistance training realm. And so could I make a case that they were experiencing some form of that? I suppose so. I definitely agree that, you know, the daily max studies are interesting, but I'm also a bit skeptical about the generalizability of that, specifically if you put it in like a trained powerlifting population, people who like actually know how to max and then truly to do that every day. So like, you know, people in the Olympic weightlifting, for example, they a lot of times do that like so-called work up to a heavy to a top single, like daily max training. But in weightlifting, because so much of that sport requires a lot of speed and power, they're not doing like, you know, 8 second grindy squat reps in that. They're working up to something like heavy enough, moves with decent bar speed, and then they do it again in the afternoon or the next day. I've done something similar in my own training before on the bench. I'm actually doing a bit of it now on squatting, although I'm doing some, you know, high bar and low bar kind of alternating, work up to a top set and move on. And it's going fine at the moment. But again, like when I think about, for example, like the heaviest lift that I ever did was like a really hard, really grindy 765 sumo deadlift. I felt terrible for almost like 2.5 weeks afterwards. Like the next week I went to deadlift, my performance was down like 10 to 12%. The next week it was still down like another 5% before things started to turn around. And so it's like, I'm like, if I was really maxing, like if I tried to do anything the next day, my performance would have been down, I don't know, 40% or something probably. And so I find it plausible if somebody is like truly taking it to that level that only somebody who is trained for true one rep max efforts, if they were doing that every day, it would not take very long before their performance would decline. But to your point, they would, you know, they may well develop an injury or something like that by continuing to force that stuff, you know, when they're clearly not ready for it. That's we see a pipeline of people into our pain and rehab programming who are doing too much too soon, or just staying too heavy too long, or refusing to vary their movements or various other kind of strategies that are less than ideal. So I find it very plausible that such a thing exists. I acknowledge that it has not been demonstrated in the evidence base very compellingly. And so that's the only basis on which I could reject this premise. But experientially and you know, from a plausibility standpoint, I think that it is likely to be a thing that can happen to people.
Yeah, I think what we probably interact with more often is like this non-functional overreaching, if you want to call it that, versus like a true overtraining syndrome. And why I think that's probably true is because when you do pull back the training or make it more appropriate based on somebody's response, they seem to do well in short order. Whereas it's not just like months and months and months of like waiting for everything to kick back in. And so I think if you want to call it non-functional overreaching and you want to, you know, maybe in your mind that's best represented by the term overtraining, okay. Like it comes back to this sort of semantics type of thing. And I think I can't bring myself to care about the overtraining risk versus non-functional overreaching risk. And so I'm more just kind of like, is the thing dosed right for the person?
Yeah, I mean, this gets to a bigger question that I talk about a lot in on the medical side of things, is what is the point of a diagnosis, right? So from my perspective as the clinician, the reason why I would seek out a specific diagnosis for a patient is insofar as it provides the label and the guidance to a unique path of management. Of course, on the patient side, having a diagnosis can have all sorts of other like effects, positive and negative, just like, you know, knowing it. But from the clinician side, I really care about the diagnosis because like, okay, now that I feel like this is the diagnosis, what am I going to do with this information? And, you know, these terms, as you said, are made up. I find them to be a little bit annoying, but whatever. Insofar as I'm going to modify training load for better tolerability and performance, I'm going to do that with both of those scenarios of non-functional overreaching and overtraining syndrome if I could ever. I mean, I basically diagnose these things never. I'm just like, oh, sounds like you're doing too much. Let's back off.
Yeah, I think we should just reject functional overreaching, non-functional overreaching, overtraining syndrome, and instead adopt like the cooking scale for steak. You should be like rare,
yeah,
medium rare, medium well, well done.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And you're like, I'm a little well.
A visual analog scale for your training dosage based on steak. I like it.
Yeah. I'm a little well done right now. So, all right, that is a wrap on Great Debates in Fitness and Health, episode number 4. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Brockie for making time out of his schedule to join me on the podcast. Thank you for listening to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Again, I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all this nuance and health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, we'll catch you next time on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.